like to be introduced as a pastor?
You can. I don't know. I still haven't gotten used to it.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Pastor Ruth Amadio, welcome to Be the People.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for doing this for me. Of course. Do you have a middle name?
Elaine.
Love. Love. And you were just telling me what your last name means in Italian?
Yes, it means loves God. The story is that when orphans would be dropped off with the nuns to be cared for, they needed to give them a last name. And so all of the orphans got the last name Amadio.
No way.
Yeah.
So are you like 100% Italian?
Let's see, a quarter. My grandfather was 100%. And then I'm a quarter Welsh. And then the rest is just miscellaneous European.
Very cool. I'm sure that the elders have told you that the founder of our church
yes.
was from Wales.
Yes.
I'm sure you've heard all about the play.
Oh, yes.
Yes. Okay, good. Okay, so for those of you who are tuning in, Ruth is actually the pastor at the church that I grew up going to. I'm technically still a member, although I know you don't see me very often.
No one's taking attendance.
Thank you. Well, that's not true, I don't think.
I'm not taking
You're
attendance.
You're not. Yeah, okay. But I've been loving the journey. So the church, and we can get into it a little bit, but was on a pretty long journey of looking for a pastor.
Yeah.
And what I didn't necessarily know about the way the Presbyterian Church operates is that it's like a really lengthy process, right?
Yes, it is.
So there were so many moving pieces, and then I did come on the day that you were being voted in, and I remember like my mom telling me, I don't know if you experienced this, but I feel like whenever my family meets a gay person, they're like, my daughter's gay. They like can't wait to say it. So she was like, oh, yeah, okay, you're gonna love it. So I came on the day that you were voted in, and it was super emotional.
Yeah,
like everyone was crying. It, for people who don't know, this church in Caddy has, I would say, like a pretty high median of age.
Yes.
Right?
But most mainline churches at this point do.
Right.
It's not uncommon.
Right. And so they've been on this long journey. They had, when I was growing up, there was one pastor for the longest time. And then there were like a couple of interim people. Then we had a lot of guests. And you are definitely the first LGBTQ pastor.
Yeah.
And it honestly, like, my whole life I've been going to that church. I've always felt very welcome, but it was probably the first time that I felt really, really safe. Mm. Not only because you were there, but seeing the way everyone was responding and how emotional everyone was and how easy it was for people to make the decision.
Yeah.
So do you mind telling me a little bit about what it was like for you?
That the process? Hiring process?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, when I was applying to different churches, I made a point in every first interview to say very openly, I am queer, I have a non-binary spouse, and it's important to me that we are both safe in whatever community we join.
Mm-hmm.
And if that is not something that a church is ready for, then it's not the place that I'm meant to be.
Did you experience churches that weren't ready for it?
Yeah, I had interviews with three different churches, including Caddy, and the first two were both pretty hesitant. One of them outright said, like, yeah, I don't know, I don't think that that's
going
to be okay. And I actually didn't hear back from either of those churches.
How did you feel when you, like, received that feedback?
I mean, separately in those interviews, I also just didn't feel like they were the right fit. So in a way, it was just a like just another box on the list of things that mm-hmm. didn't quite work. But it was hard to think, like, I have witnessed other queer friends have a really difficult time finding a job because of so many churches, especially depending on where in the country you're looking for a job, so many churches have a really hard time with that.
Mm-hmm.
So I was kind of prepared to like have an interim in between seminary and career of just trying to find the right fit. And it worked out well for me, but it doesn't for everybody.
So were you surprised when you said it in your first interview with this church, were you surprised at how they responded?
I actually didn't have to say it first because there was a queer person on the search committee.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that he made it a point in all of the interviews to name that he had a husband outright. And so it was like I automatically feel comfortable. It was probably within the first 5 minutes that he said it. So I automatically felt a lot more comfortable coming into that interview and still stated my own identity, but didn't feel nervous about it anymore, knowing that that was a part of their church community already.
Yeah. sorry, I'm just picturing my mom being like, I have a gay daughter. And I can only imagine.
She did.
So excited. So did you feel throughout the whole, like the vibe that I got on that day, I'd heard so many great things about you, but it felt as if you felt the same way that the search committee felt, where it was like, this is the perfect fit. Did it feel that way for you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like I said, the other two churches, I just didn't feel like it was right. Like, it felt very awkward talking to them. And knowing, like, being a pastor is a weird job. You're a part of a community. It's not just a 9-to-5 office job. You're with this group of people very intimately.
Mm-hmm.
So it needed to be something... It needed to be somewhere where I felt comfortable with the people. And right away in that first interview, I felt like I had known these people way longer than an hour and a half. Like, it just was very organic talking to them.
I love that.
So, yeah. I mean, I think they would all tell you very similar things.
Mm-hmm.
It just felt right.
Yeah. And... did you feel, and you don't have to speak on this if you don't want to speak on their behalf, but has it been at all hard to, like, I think obviously from my experience, the church is super accepting,
mm-hmm.
but I still think there's a lot of even older generations who might be really comfortable saying, like, lesbian, gay, queer, they mm-hmm. might not be as understanding about people's pronouns or non-binary people. So have you experienced any of that, or do you feel like it's been somewhat?
Yeah, it's hard for people. Mare would tell you that they're not the type to be offended if their pronouns are used incorrectly.
Mm-hmm.
My spouse is Mare. They use they them pronouns. But they get called she all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But what matters to them more is that I think they can get a sense of when somebody is trying mm-hmm. and when they're not.
Yeah.
And they've been a part of this community alongside me and know that these people are not meaning wrong by it.
Mm-hmm.
They're just learning.
Did Mare use they, them pronouns when you first met them?
Yes.
Okay. So it was kind of just how you've always known.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's easy for me if that's the way that I've always known them.
Yeah.
But I have friends who have changed their pronouns after I've known them, and that's hard.
Yeah.
To just rewrite how you address somebody that you've known.
It's 100% hard, and I always say that to my mom and my gram, like, it's hard for anyone.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also such a simple way of really showing your allyship and your inclusion. And so, like, you should really, really, really try. So
yeah.
I hope they have been.
Yeah.
When did you first decide you wanted to be a pastor?
When I was 18, which I think is probably quite young.
Yeah. Well, actually, I was thinking it would be even younger. It feels like a calling.
Yeah. I can tell my call story.
Yeah.
I, from a young age, thought I wanted to be a teacher. Mm-hmm. I loved school. Huge nerd. So from like kindergarten, I was like, yeah, I'm going to be a teacher. I know what I want. This is what I'm going to do. It shifted a little bit in high school. I thought I wanted to do speech pathology in schools, but still a form of teaching. And I had always been involved in the church. My parents actually met at the church I grew up in.
No way.
So as I got older, I was able to be more involved in different parts of the church community. I started to read parts of the liturgy and pray the prayers of the people in front of the church. And one Sunday during communion, the pastor said to me, you know, I think that you should go to seminary. I think you'd be a really good pastor.
Wow.
Like, what are you talking about? I'm a senior in high school and I've already applied to college, already accepted an offer for a college and declared my major there. I already know what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I don't need another thing. Thanks, but no thanks. But it was one of those things that, like, the thought didn't really go away. Mm. And so it felt like the Holy Spirit was nudging at me.
Did you have a really strong sense of faith at that point?
I suppose. I guess, you know, some people will talk about, like, oh, I accepted Christ into my heart at such and such age. I don't really have a story like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just always been a part of my life.
Mm-hmm.
We went to church every Sunday. That was just how it was.
Yeah.
So, like, yes, but I also can't pinpoint a time when it wasn't.
Yeah. It was just kind of a part of your upbringing.
Yeah.
And because I saw that your degrees were in psychology and conflict management.
Yeah.
So how did that, is that what you knew you wanted to major in when you went?
No. So once I decided to accept the call to be a pastor, I was like, well, now what? Because speech pathology doesn't make sense anymore.
Right.
So I spent most of my freshman year with no major trying to figure out what to do. You know, I could have done like a biblical studies theology kind of major, but I was given advice to not do that because you get so much of that in seminary. And there's more to being a pastor than just knowing the Bible. It's a lot more like work with people, and that piece was important. So, psychology, I thought about doing as my one major, but my parents were worried about wanting me to have a backup job if I didn't go to seminary.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't do anything with psychology really without a master's degree. So it would be a similar, like, there's nothing straight out of undergrad that you can do with that.
Mm-hmm.
So I took an intro to conflict management class kind of on a whim. My RA said, hey, there's another kid who's doing this, and I think this sounds like something that would work with what you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I immediately fell in love with it. I think I was in the class for 2 weeks and declared it as my major.
Wow, dang. Quick.
Yeah. You know, unfortunately, there is a lot of conflict in churches and in denominations, and it felt like something that would be helpful both in personal and professional life. My professors were a lot of hippies, so it was really, like, fun and a small major, really personal.
Comes in handy.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you say go to seminary, how long is that program?
Typically, most pastors are going to get a Master of Divinity, which is a 3-year program, I got 2 master's degrees, overachiever.
Wow.
I did the Master of Divinity and a Master of Christian Education and Formation.
Cool.
So that was a 4-year dual degree.
And this was at Princeton.
Yes.
And this is where you met Mare.
It is, yes.
Were you out when you decided also that you wanted to become a pastor?
I realized that I was queer late. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until the summer between college and seminary that I realized that I was bi. So I was a little bit nervous going into seminary, like not knowing what kinds of people would be there, whether mm-hmm. that was going to be a safe place for me to be out. And it turns out it was, and it was fine, but it did take me a couple of months to be open about that.
Mm-hmm. Do you still identify as bi?
Yeah. Yeah.
And when you say realized later, like, were you, when you were little, did you really have crushes on boys and felt that it was genuine?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think growing up in a Christian community, it was not that I grew up in a very conservative household or even church, just that it was kind of part of the culture at the time that, like, it's just not something that you do. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of not that I felt like I wasn't allowed, but like it just wasn't ever an option.
Not mainstream.
Yeah.
Makes 100%. Yes, makes sense.
So yeah, in college, almost all of my friends were queer. Okay. And I think being around them and really getting to know them during the 4 years of college really helped me to, like, open up my worldview and my friends used to say that I was the gayest straight person that they knew. And it was a joke for a while until it wasn't. And yeah. I was like, wait, what if I'm actually not straight?
Yeah. Yeah. How long did it take you to tell your family?
A couple of months, but not too long. I was nervous in the sense that, like, I was telling my parents that I was someone different than they thought, mm-hmm. but not in the sense that, like, I thought that they wouldn't love me. Mm-hmm. Like, they were always really lovely and accepting to all of my queer friends, mm-hmm. and that was such a good sign for how they would love me. Yeah. And they're just lovely people in general.
So it wasn't an issue even, like, bringing Mare around?
No. Well, by the time I brought Mare around, it had been a couple of years that they had known.
Yeah.
It still took a little bit of getting used to.
Right.
And my parents actually went to therapy to kind of reckon with their own feelings without making it my problem.
Damn! Take notes. That's crazy. That's so cool.
So, yeah, not to say that it was easy, but I never felt unloved.
So my question is, and I'm sorry if you feel that this is ignorant, but, like, the way I've always taught, my mom asks me a lot about the letters. And so I always describe, you know, L is cisgendered person, cisgendered woman loving another cisgendered woman. And then, you know, gay is the same for men. And then B is usually, you know, that for cisgender male and female. If your partner's non-binary, if you're attracted to non-binary people, do you feel like that might be more of, like, the Q? Or do you still feel like, no, I identify with the B and that's my letter?
Yeah, I think bi just feels easiest. Mm-hmm. There's so many different labels, more than I actually even know. Probably the most accurate would be pansexual, which is like everyone mm-hmm. instead of just men and women. I think that would probably be more all-encompassing.
And pan, isn't pan also associated with personality? Or is that something else that I'm thinking of?
I think it might be something else.
Yeah, but I feel like it starts with a P. There are a lot of labels out there. That's why I'm curious, because people always ask me the differences. And I'm like, I think technically this is it, but also you can be whatever you want to be.
Yeah.
Period. Okay, so obviously the dichotomy between being a person who's out in the LGBTQ community and also someone with a really strong faith who's in the church, how easy is that to coexist for you? And have you ever run into times where it hasn't been?
Yeah, it's been a journey for me. And so in that sense, it feels almost seamless in that I've never felt like my queerness and my faith have conflicted. But I had done a lot of deconstructing to get to that point. In the summer between high school and college, I did essentially a theology camp at Calvin Seminary in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I grew up not Presbyterian. I grew up Christian Reformed, and Calvin is the like Christian Reformed hub. And during that time, I was kind of exploring for myself what I believed about queer affirmation in the church. And so I remember asking questions about like, I think I said something along the lines of like, it doesn't make sense for us to say that people can't love who they want to love if God is about love. Mm-hmm. And someone pulled out a magazine article that some professor had written that cited a bunch of Bible verses. And I remember reading it and being like, yeah, but this doesn't answer my question. This doesn't feel like it's getting to the heart of faith. You're citing a bunch of academic stuff, but it doesn't feel right to me. Mm-hmm. And so I took a little bit of time to sit with that and decided, you know what? There's so much more in the Bible that's pointing towards loving everyone that feels like it trumps these few verses. And now, having done a whole degree in this stuff, I can say that those are clobber texts that have been deconstructed by a bunch of queer theologians. But, by the time I realized that I was queer, I had already done that work, and would have already said that there is space for queerness in the church.
Yeah. Do you have, I just feel like in the queer community, there are so many people, for lack of a better way of saying it, who feel like almost like anti-church, or they feel really hurt by the church. And so how do you navigate that? Do you have close friends who feel that way? Or, what do you say and how do you rectify it?
Yeah, I have plenty of friends who feel that way. And I completely understand. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I think I feel very lucky for the upbringing that I had, that even before I had conversations with my parents about my own identity, that it was never, none of our beliefs were ever coming from a place of hate. Mm-hmm. But that's not the case for a lot of people. I'm never going to force any of my queer friends into a church space, because that's not helpful. Mm-hmm. I just try to be an example of what it can be.
I love that.
And I have friends who would say, like, they would never go to church, but they would come to my church. Mm. Like, that they know me and trust me, and that that has been healing for them in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. But that faith spaces in general still don't feel safe. I think a lot of the work has to be done on a personal level. And it makes me sad that there are a lot of queer folks who don't feel welcome in the church. Mm-hmm. But all of that trauma is really hard to undo.
Yeah. What do you wish you could say to someone who does kind of use their beliefs to weaponize queerness?
Hmm. I think that's hard to answer because I still haven't figured out how to talk to those people.
Such a nice way to put it. I would pop off.
That's the problem, though, is that, like, saying the things that I want to say, that's not helping.
Right.
Like, you would think with the whole conflict management degree that I would have figured this out, but it's a lot easier when it's not your own problems.
Right.
Yeah. I wish that I could say, you know, so many people who are strong in their faith, who are involved in their churches, feel like it's a place where they can feel loved by God. And hopefully feel safe and forgiven. So I think I would want to say, if you get to feel safe and loved and chosen, why can't everyone?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you see Disclosure Day?
Not yet. No. Oh. I really want to.
It's so good, and it really makes you think about these things and, like, how humans would respond to a whole other society or species among yeah. us, and, like, how we would treat them and why sometimes it feels like we can't treat each other that way. Yeah. It really, like, I had a lump in my throat the last, like, 30 minutes the entire time because it was wild. You have now to see it.
I'm more excited to see it than I was before.
You have to see it. It's so existential, and no pun intended, but it really is.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you take the Bible at face value? When I have come and listened to your sermons, I liked – there was one – I think my mom sent it to me, and she was like, you have to listen to Pastor Ruth's sermon. It was so good, and it was about – oh, no, I think I was there in person, and it was – you took a verse basically, but you kind of broke it down and said, like, you know, it doesn't literally mean this. It yeah. means this, which made me wonder if that's kind of how you approach it overall, or if you do take it more literally.
Yeah, that is my approach for the most part. There are so many different genres in the Bible. It's not just history. Some of it is, but a lot of it isn't. Some of it is poetry. A lot of the language in there is metaphorical, or you have stories that Jesus is telling that didn't happen, but he's trying to make a point. Mm. And so a lot of the work of biblical interpretation is not just taking it at face value, but trying to find what the meaning is in there to kind of pull it apart and look deeper. And it's hard. There's passages sometimes that I really just want to throw out and not preach on. Mm-hmm. So a lot of my work during the week is figuring out what answers I have for myself before I'm sharing that with a congregation.
Yeah. Do you go in order when you're working through? Like, I remember sometimes growing up, our pastor would be like, oh, we're working through the book of, you know, whatever it might be. How do you, what's your strategy?
So there's something called the lectionary that a committee of people has chosen passages for every Sunday. Actually, I think there's passages for days during the week too, but every Sunday. So it's on a 3-year cycle. We're on year A right now. But they choose an Old Testament, New Testament, Gospel, and Psalm. And sometimes there's alternates that you can choose one or the other, Old Testament, whatever. I, for the most part, follow the lectionary.
Okay.
Our church only does 2 scripture readings, so I choose which of the 4 I feel like preaching on. During holiday seasons like Advent and Lent, we were doing a thematic series. And, you know, there might be some Sundays where something has happened in the world that needs to be spoken on.
Mm-hmm.
So that might change my plan. But for the most part, I'm following an order that someone else has chosen because I don't want it to be just what I personally am feeling compelled by that I'm preaching on every Sunday.
Yeah.
I want to discover what the Holy Spirit is calling me to say. There's fancy words for it that I could give, but I'm not sure that would be helpful. Mostly, it's a difference between finding what God is saying versus putting what I'm saying into the Bible.
I was gonna ask, like, in today's world, how do you not, with how heavy the political climate is and how polarizing things can be, how do you, I mean, you go in probably knowing that everyone's experiencing this. Maybe some people are watching CNN, some people are watching Fox. How do you navigate that?
It's hard. anytime I preach a sermon that's politically charged, I'm nervous beforehand. I haven't actually had anybody say anything to me about any of them in a negative light, but I'm sure that somebody in the pews is uncomfortable anytime that I'm naming political realities. I think it's part of my job to say the uncomfortable thing.
Mm-hmm.
Not every sermon that I preach is going to be political or uncomfortable. It's a balance of doing pastoral care and doing heartwarming and uplifting sermons alongside the uncomfortable and hard sermons. There should be a mix in the types of things that I'm saying, but I don't think I would be a good pastor if I never challenged anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I say political, I don't mean that I'm saying, like, well, you should vote for this person.
Right.
Or you have to be this political party. Or nothing like that. But, you know, Jesus was a political figure.
Mm-hmm.
This was somebody who was hugely in opposition to the empire.
Ironic.
So it's part of my job to say, you know, these are the things that Jesus preached, and are we living that out in our life right now? And if not, what needs to change?
Mm-hmm. When you... Okay, there are, like, certain things that I feel like it could just be, not a myth, but, like, just a very blanket stereotype.
Yeah.
Certain things that people talk about with religion, like, you know, no sex before marriage, or like baptizing your baby, or having a child out of wedlock, things like that.
Yeah.
Do you consider those to be old school, or are those some rules that you actually subscribe to?
I guess I would say for the most part old school. But my more complicated answer is that, you know, people talk about a lot of those things as, like, sins. And I think sin is a lot more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm.
One piece of it is that, like, there's no hierarchy of sins. It's just as bad to lie to your mom as it is to have sex before marriage, right? Like, if you believe that sex before marriage is a sin, which I don't, but that's beside the point.
Mm-hmm.
That all of the things that we label as sin are equally bad. And so looking at someone and saying, oh, well, you had a kid out of wedlock, so you're worse than me, that's not accurate. We're all fallen. We all sin. None of us are perfect. It's not helpful to nitpick who's doing what.
Love that. When you were selecting what religion you or what denomination you would want to become a part of, were there certain things about Presbyterian that made you attracted to it, or did it just happen that way?
Yeah. So at the time, I was actually more worried about being a woman in ministry than being a queer person in ministry.
Oh, okay.
The Christian Reformed Church, CRC for short, they do ordain women, but a lot of those women don't end up in solo pastor or head pastor jobs. I did a thesis my senior year of undergrad, and I interviewed women in ministry in the CRC and the Presbyterian Church and the UCC, the United Church of Christ, and kind of compared between the three and saw what kind of conflict existed for women in ministry in the different denominations. And I was doing it for academic reasons, but I was also doing it for myself because I didn't know whether I could stay Christian Reformed or if I needed to switch, and if I did, what to. And the women that I talked to in the CRC made it clear for me that I didn't feel comfortable staying Christian Reformed. And I actually got some statistics, and I believe at the time there were only 10 women in the whole denomination that were solo or head pastors.
Why? Just like inherent misogyny, or like what was the deal?
I mean, that's a complicated question. Every denomination that ordains women now has at some point gone through a conflict to decide that women could be pastors. It was just a lot more recent for the CRC than for the Presbyterian Church. I think at the time it had been 20 or 25 years since they had decided that women could be pastors.
Wow.
And it's been a lot longer for the PCUSA, Presbyterian Church.
Nice. That makes me proud. Try not to curse. I almost just, like, it doesn't matter. Anyways.
Yeah, the PCUSA has made a lot of decisions that do make me really proud, and that is a lot of the reason that I chose this denomination, that the structure and a lot of the theology of the Christian Reformed Church and the PCUSA were similar. They're both Reformed denominations. I won't get into all of the historical junk with that, but the difference was that the PCUSA felt more welcoming and, I guess I will say, liberal, even though that term comes with a whole bunch of baggage too, in ways that I needed it to be. That aligned with who I was as a person a lot more at the time.
Yeah.
But yeah, the PCUSA has made a lot of decisions that are really great. Not that every denomination has their problems. We're all imperfect in our own ways. But General Assembly happened for the PCUSA recently, and one of the things that the denomination decided to do is to divest from oil companies and one of the, I can't remember the name, one of the AI companies. Mm. So to divest our money from companies that we don't feel align with our faith.
Yeah.
And that's really cool.
That is cool. Do you, there are still denominations who won't marry same-sex couples, right?
Oh, yeah.
I think
yeah.
Catholicism is one of them, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And Catholicism is the one where, my wife always talks about this, the communion, the first communion kind of feels like you're marrying Jesus. Isn't that right? Like with the white dress and everything?
Faith is weird sometimes.
Right, right, right. I don't remember ever doing that. Given that, as we said, the median age of this congregation is pretty high, you at times, you know, unless there's kids in the pews, might be the youngest person at church that day, but you're also the one teaching and giving messages and lessons.
Yeah.
Does that ever make you feel weird, or do you just...
Yeah, in some senses it is weird. Yeah. I think when I was applying to jobs, I kind of thought of my identity almost as a like weird checklist of things that were kind of going against me. Of like, I'm a woman, I'm young, and I'm queer.
Right.
And all of these things are hard for the kind of job that I'm going for.
Yeah.
So yeah, in that sense, I have been nervous about it, but I think being more comfortable and at home in the job that I'm in, it's been almost a year now. So I'm starting to feel more accustomed to this community, and they're more accustomed to me, and that helps a lot.
It felt like you were exactly what the church needed, and I genuinely just felt so proud. It was the first time that I left church feeling like just real, like a real sense of love and light. Mm-hmm. And not that it never felt good, like I feel really lucky to have been brought up in a church that didn't feel culty, for lack of a better word. It felt more authentic and like
sure
welcoming. But that was the first day that, I don't know, it was like, I just feel like it couldn't have been a better fit. And I think you're bringing them exactly what they all need as well.
Yeah.
For sure. really important tangent that we need to discuss. You are a Dungeons and Dragons player, correct?
Yes, I am.
And you were explaining to me recently that sometimes games of D&T can take, wait, D&D, no, D&D.
Yeah.
Okay. What did I say? Doesn't matter. Can take years.
Yeah, there are people that have been playing the same campaign for like 20 years.
Dang. Do you have a group of people that you always play with?
Unfortunately, not right now.
Oh.
Couple that we were playing with broke up, and that kind of ended the campaign.
Oh, no.
But that's okay. Not every campaign is that long. A lot of them are a lot shorter.
What do you mean campaign? The game?
So think of it like kind of like a TV show that like you're following the same characters for years.
Okay, so you're
there might be like seasons of the larger campaign, but it's one world, it's one group of characters, it's one big story.
Okay, so is it always a four-person game?
No, you can, I wouldn't play, well, you could maybe play with two people, but I wouldn't really do any less than three.
Okay.
You need a DM, a dungeon master, or sometimes people
not call a them direct message.
No.
Got it.
Sometimes people call them game masters. And then players, I wouldn't do any less than two, but four is a relatively ideal number. 4 to 6 is probably the ideal range.
Do you prefer playing with advanced and experienced D&D players?
I'm not advanced.
Okay. So beginner is fine.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you're listening out there and you're a fellow D&D player, Ruth and Mare are looking for...
Mare is always looking for people to play with. And Mare's thing is trying to figure out how you can incorporate games like Dungeons and Dragons, but other things, into ministry.
No way!
Yeah, their dream is to have a board game cafe ministry.
That's very cool. I think there is something somewhat like that in Bethlehem.
Yeah. There are different board game cafes around that are pretty great.
And Mare is where you met Mare through seminary. So Mare is also in this field. They have
the same 2 degrees that I do.
Dang. Meant to be. Meant to be.
But yeah, they currently work for the Institute for Youth Ministry at the seminary.
I did know that. That's so cool. And I love Mare. They're a great time. Well, those are all my questions for you.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. And thank you for being so open. And I hope, you know, someone who's listening out there knows that there is a church that they can feel welcome in. Thanks to you.
That's always my hope.
All right. Thanks, Ruth. Thanks for listening.